Kevin, could you start your recording?
Recording.
And Andrew?
All right, recording.
And Michael?
Recording.
All right, here we go. You're listening to the Useful Science Podcast. This is episode 7, recorded on December 13th, 2015. This week, we're covering articles from the education section of our site. We're going to learn about teaching children that intelligence is malleable, merit badges, and depressed roommates. Useful Science is a website where we post one-sentence summaries of scientific research relevant to your everyday life. On this podcast, we're going to bring on a rotating panel of our science contributors to pick out a few items from the Useful Science archives and dive deep into them. So while the website gives you the short, tweetable version of scientific research, our goal here is to give you the full story. Let's meet our host for this week.
Hi, my name is Kevin Nybert. I did my PhD in pharmacology and therapeutics at McGill. My thesis work was focused on the development and preclinical testing of nanoparticles for medicine, but more recently I've transitioned into the video game industry, where I use my scientific background to create more authentic, immersive, and memorable experiences for players.
And hi, my name is Andrew Blevins. I'm a writer and editor living in New York City. I graduated from the University of Georgia with a degree in English and cognitive science. I'm not technically a scientist myself, but I love to read about science and to learn about it, and I'm glad to be here.
Hi, my name is Michael Galtis. I'm a PhD chemist working at the University of Cambridge. I do solid-state chemistry, and I develop new materials that are hopefully going to be useful for society, many of them for energy purposes, such as battery materials or generating electricity.
So let's start with that merit badges article. Kevin, could you walk us through that?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. The useful science summary for this one is awarding an educational merit badge, a digital representation of student knowledge or skill mastery, may be a useful tool to motivate and measure learning in young students. The title of the paper, it's a bit of a spoiler. The first part asks the question, are badges useful for education? And then it answers its own question saying, it depends on the type of badge and expertise of the learner. This work was carried out by a group of researchers from the Learning Research and Development Center at the University of Pittsburgh, and it was published in the Journal of Educational Technology Research and Development. So just before we dig into the article a little bit, I think it's important to talk about what educational badges are exactly. So just the basics, an educational badge is essentially some sort of symbol that signifies a concrete learning accomplishment, like learning a new skill. And then once that skill is learned, the learner can proudly display their badge to let other people know that they've mastered that particular skill or they have that new knowledge. So just to put it into context for everyone, there's the most familiar type of these merit badges, I think, would be one that's related to traditionally like the Boy or the Girl Scout organizations. So the Boy and Girl Scouts have been giving out merit badges for about 100 years. And essentially how it works is you get a merit badge based on the completion of specific knowledge or skill that are not formally addressed in the normal educational system. So children can select what badges they want to earn. They then carry out the necessary steps to like fulfill that eligibility criteria, and then they're given a badge. And the general theory is that there's a goal of earning the badge, which will trigger an increased motivation for the learner, and then they're rewarded with formal recognition from their peers. So a scout's display of their earned badges on their sash represents a summary, or kind of like a resume, if you will, of what learning they've undergone, and also what sort of things they value. So you get an idea of what the person's interested in, what their skills are. So I did a little bit of research into the Boy and Girl Scouts organization, Association of America. And just to give you an idea of how commonplace this is, between 1911 and 2011, so about 100 years, the Boy Scouts of America have awarded 113 million merit badges, and up to 2 million alone in the year 2011. And I did a bit of reading, and I found that there's over 133 different badge types, and each badge has its own completion criteria. So if you were to rank the top 100 badges related on how frequently they're awarded to people, in the top 10 you have badges like first aid, like swimming, environmental science, camping, personal fitness, that sort of stuff. And if you look down at the bottom of the list, there's things like composite materials, drafting, surveying, the ever popular stamp collecting, American labor, journalism.
Wait, American labor?
American labor, yeah.
Like,
what is that?
I'll look it up.
No, you don't have to.
Sounds like maybe like
exploiting the working class.
Right. cleaning your room, doing the dishes for a change.
Doing the dishes. There's also near the bottom of the list, there's badges for American business, sustainability, bugling, which is really big these days. And actually, there's a merit badge for programming, which is one of the newer merit badges that have been introduced. Also, just of note for fun, a couple other merit badges really jumped out at me. There's a merit badge for rifle shooting, which came in at number 13. Wow. A merit badge for fingerprinting, which came in at 14. If there's some sort of connection there, I'm not sure.
Wait, 14? That's the 14th most popular
the 14th
skill
most popular.
For Boy Scouts is fingerprinting?
It's probably pretty easy, I'd say.
Oh,
it's
I
maybe
see.
Like a check I got it off you. The list.
It's do like, you have a fingerprint? Yes.
Success. And the one final one of particular note that came in at number 69 was nuclear science, that's a good one.
Wow.
So I think in general, most people are familiar with the more traditional merit badge style that the Boy and Girl Scouts Organization of America uses. The second one, the second sort of model of educational badges are more related to video games. And for people who are familiar with that, you'll know of them more as like achievements. But for those
Steam
who are...
Steam badge, absolutely.
Yes, exactly. For those that are not quite as familiar, when we talk about video game achievements... essentially, what you're doing is you're awarding a player for completing goals that are defined outside of the normal gameplay. So it feeds into the more meta game, which is the game on top of the game. So it's not like a secret or a power-up, where those are things that actually change your experience. They might make you stronger or faster. Achievements actually don't have a direct effect on the gameplay experience. So your character doesn't get any stronger or anything like that. However, within the achievement ecosystem, players can compare their achievements to their peers or to their friends to see who's has a greater mastery of the game. And players can earn specific badges ahead of time by completing specific tasks. But also you can earn achievements just from playing through the game more passively. So this is, in this way, there's two sort of different systems of reward. There's badges for specific skill and mastery achievements. So that would be like beating the game at the hardest level of difficulty. You'd get an achievement for that. But there's also more passive achievements, which would be collect 10,000 points or defeat 1,000 enemies. These are things that just happen as you play, and you'll also receive achievements for that. And this concept of rewarding players for both mastery and participation becomes really important when we discuss the more nuts and bolts of the paper. So keep that in the back of your mind. So today we're going to be talking a little bit about digital educational badges, which is interesting because they share some of the features of traditional merit badges from the Boy Scouts, but also some of the features of video game achievements. And the idea is to address one of the major problems in modern instructional design, or like designing classes for students, is that many of the current test taking and educational assessments can sometimes be a double-edged sword. On one hand, you have these tests that serve as a gauge of student learning and provide necessary feedback. But on the other hand, if students feel like they're being over-assessed or unfairly assessed, they become motivated to seek a mastery of the exam rather than a mastery of actually learning the material. So it gets a bit tricky. So the idea is that because motivation is a known key of learning, the idea is that with these digital educational badges, you can get the potential benefit of an assessment tool, but also helps to maintain that motivation to learn. And along the progress of learning, the digital education badges will provide feedback as a student is learning. So that helps to set up, I guess, the basic introduction and the premise of the study. So there's actually a couple of good examples of organizations that already use digital merit badges. There's the Mozilla Backpack and Khan Academy. For those who are not familiar, the Khan Academy is sort of like an online Learn at Your Own Speed curriculum website, and you can actually earn badges for completing various modules and learning assessments. Okay, so essentially the researchers had two key questions. They wanted to know if badges have a different motivation relationship for different ability learner, and also do badges of different types, so that's the more skill-based mastery and the passive badges, do those have different motivation relationships with learners? So to answer these questions, what they did is they took a group of 36 seventh graders and 15 eighth graders, and they had them participate in the study. They used a survey system where they were able to measure the students' motivations by answering a series of questions. And there were three key types of motivation that they were looking for. One is characterized by the sentence, "One of my goals this year is to master a lot of new math skills and math." And this is a measure of a mastery goal. They measured the performance approach goal using a sentence that says, "It's important to me that I look smart compared to others in math." And the third type of goal that they measured were performance avoidance goals. And that's characterized by, "One of my goals in math is to avoid looking like I have trouble doing the work." And this was assessed using this survey, and they answered on a scale from 1 to 5. And what was really clever, before they began the study, each of the student had to perform this pretest, which essentially assessed their starting math skill and their math abilities. And then students were separated into a low-performing group and a high-performing group. So throughout the study, and they measured the students' motivation levels using their survey, and each student spent about 20 minutes every school day with this digital online tutoring system, which we can talk about in more detail in at the end with the discussion. But essentially how it worked is they learned to use various mathematical reasoning skills through this digital tutor. And the overall goal was to program a robot on the screen to move certain distances and turn at certain angles, which the students had to calculate within the context of solving this larger problem where they had to control this robot on a distant asteroid. And what's really neat about this digital tutoring system is that if the students got stuck, it was able to provide them little prompts and little hints to help them complete the solution. But they only got credit for completing it if they were able to do so without getting one of the answers wrong or without getting a hint from the digital tutor. So basically how it worked is students, as they were using this platform, they earned a whole bunch of different badges. And every time they earned a badge, they were notified through a dialog box within the interface. So they knew that they had succeeded and were being rewarded for their achievements. Originally, students were unaware of which badges would be available, which we can talk more about the discussion. But the students then would discuss with each other and compare which badges they had got to learn more about the potential of which badges would become available. And so when we started the study, we have these two groups. We have the low-performing group and the high-performing group. And they were all challenged with these math questions. And what the researchers found is that the low-performing group had a decrease in performance avoidance motivation, which is characterized by, "One of my goals in math is to avoid looking like I have trouble doing the work." And in general, they reported an increased interest in math throughout using this digital tutor. What was really interesting is that the high-performing students, they exhibited no significant change in performance avoidance or interest. What else was really interesting is that the low-performing students, when they measured the performance approach motivation, and that's characterized by the sentence, "It's important to me that I look smart compared to others in math," that generally correlated with the total number of badges earned throughout the study. So we can take these results together and say, it looks like for the low-performing students, those ones that had a higher desire to outperform the other students tended to earn more badges overall. But conversely, the high-performing students, they actually had a negative correlation between performance avoidance and total number of badges. So those students who were less concerned about having a poor performance relative to the other students didn't earn quite as many badges. There's one more really interesting finding that came out from the paper. Once they found that these students that the motivation towards earning badges tend to be related to their pre-test math ability, where the ones who were lower performers tended to earn more badges. They wanted to see if there was a difference in student motivation based on the badge types. So I mentioned earlier there's like a passive badges that are rewarded for just participating and skill-based. So just to give you an example of that, a skill-based badge would be complete a problem with no errors and under 1 minute, or complete a problem with no errors in less than 5 minutes, where a participatory badge would be 30 minutes of cumulative tutor time, or answer 25 questions correctly. These are things you get just by participating within the program. So what they found is that for the low-performing students, the pre-performance approach motivation, that's it's important to me that I look smart when completing when competing to others in math, was correlated with the participation badges, but not the skill badges. And conversely, for the high-performing students, their pre-performance avoidance, which is it's important to me that I don't look stupid in math, had a negative correlation with skill badges, but no correlation with participation badges. So basically, when you take all these findings together, the take-home message is that digital badge earning is driven by learner motivations, and this digital tutor system that awards badges could have a positive effect on critical learner modifications. And more importantly, badge acquisition patterns are different across learners. So it depends if you have a pre-existing skill or not. And different types of badges also affect different types of learners differently. So kind of it's really important to like keep this in mind when establishing how educational badges should be awarded. And obviously more research is necessary to understand kind of the broader motivational impacts of badges under different circumstances, and also to see the impact of this effect at other ages or in different learning environments.
So if we take, let's say as an example, a high-performing student who says that it is important to them that people view them as being good at math, what are they doing? Are they not going for the achievement-based badges, or what are they doing?
So for the high-performing students, for them, there was a correlation with earning the skill-based badges.
Yeah.
In contrast, for the low-performing students, it was more based on earning participation-based badges.
I got it. So the high-performing students are trying to get the badges that reward them for skills, while the low-performing students are going for the badges that reward them for participation.
That's right. And the high-performing students are less concerned about how the other students perceive their achievements and perceive their mastery of the skills, mostly because they're aware of their current ability. Like, they know that they're high-performing students. And this is actually interesting. It reminds me, just talking about it now, how back when I was in fourth grade, we had posters on the wall of the classroom where students who submitted these book reports, which was like a one-page report, every student had their name on the wall, and you'd get a little sticker every time you submitted a book report. And I remember when I was young, just reading like really these really short, kind of like goosebump style books, and reading as many as I could, and writing up my one-page book reports, and getting those little stars on the wall. And I definitely fell into the trap of being motivated by these merit badges on the wall, because I could see that, I read all 50 Goosebump books, you know? So, like, I definitely remember having this, well,
that was
this system
reward.
In place.
That was what?
I said that was its own reward, reading,
yeah,
reading all 50 Goosebumps.
That's it.
Were those any good? I don't remember if they were actually good or not. I did read a few of those as a kid.
I don't remember either. I remember liking them a lot.
I remember being encouraged by my teacher to read greater works after I completed maybe the 30 Goosebumps book.
Is it important that these merit badges be public? I would assume it is. Is this about students wanting to impress their friends, or is this about some other intrinsic feeling of satisfaction that you get from getting the sticker on the wall or whatever?
I think it's definitely an extrinsic motivator. It's about showing off your progression. It's about showing off your mastery to your colleagues. I think that's a big part of it, because we also see this effect in when I was talking about like video game achievements. There's people who compete to have the most achievements. So actually, I was doing a little extra research this morning. There's a platform, a digital distribution platform called Steam, which people can buy video games online. It's for PC players. And there's people who buy games. There's a third-party website that tracks everyone's global achievement. And there are 5 players right now. Each of them own over 4,000 games on Steam, which is insane. Oh. And each of them have over 25,000 achievements. So it's like the goal of getting achievements in itself is motivating them to purchase more games and get more achievements and sort of compete on this leaderboard between each other.
So they call that achievement farming, particularly for some games. I remember one of my friends with Xbox achievements bought Avatar The Last Airbender because there was a whole bunch of points that you could get for doing almost nothing. And so they just get the games that have the easiest achievements so you can get the most points as soon as possible. So yeah, it's called farming or achievement farming.
That's exactly what I was thinking. This is the Goosebumps problem again, where but these guys are not, they're probably not playing the best games. It's like, oh, if there's a there's a version of like Solitaire that gets you 1,000 achievements, then go for it.
Yeah, this is the metagame, right? Yeah. This is then you're then evaluating to the test, or you're optimizing for the evaluation, or in this case, you would be optimizing for the badge system. But I mean, I think it's an interesting question, is even if you're doing that, are you still accomplishing, or is the system still accomplishing its goals? So by forcing you to practice whatever 25,000 math questions, it gets you that badge, even if you do it for the wrong reasons. I mean, is the system still effective?
Have you guys ever done the online traffic school thing? Like, you get a ticket and then you do online traffic school to get the point removed off your record. Have you guys done that before?
No,
my driving record is immaculate.
Well, I've done it a couple times, but the reason why I bring it up is that it's like an online class. You're supposed to read this stuff and you're supposed to answer some questions, and they tell you up front that it takes, this will take you an hour to do. But if you just don't do it right, if you just don't even do the reading and just guess at the questions, or maybe like open up the questions in a separate tab so you can go back and forth, you can finish it in about 5 minutes and then it's just done. So, but you're not really learning anything. Like, I haven't really learned my lesson. So I'm wondering if you do things like that, if you're like gamifying education, if you're saying to these kids, hey, get these badges to prove that to prove to yourself and your friends that you've learned this information. I wonder if you're maybe giving them the wrong motivation at times, and they might not necessarily be learning, but just be figuring out what's the amount of work I have to do in order to get these badges without necessarily caring about understanding the content of the lesson.
Also, the most useful thing I've learned from this episode, how to reduce the number of points on my driver.
I think to your point, definitely the more extrinsic style of motivation, that's where you're being awarded badges or you get your gold sticker for your book report. Those are more like short-term fixes. It's really, the key is to get students to get that intrinsic motivation where it's the goal to succeed and like goal to learn. It's not about getting the sticker and the reward and that sort of stuff. And I think that's really the most challenging thing to do, is to have students really get that intrinsic motivation where they're not doing it just for the reward, you know?
So I'm talking to Derek Muller, who you may know from his YouTube channel, Veritasium, which has over 3 million subscribers and a couple hundred science videos, and it's really fantastic. You may have also seen him on TV. He's hosted shows for PBS, for the Australian ABC. He's working on a new series for Discovery International and Science Channel. And Derek has a degree in engineering physics from Queen's University in Ontario and a PhD in physics education research from the University of Sydney. So Derek, first of all, thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
So I'm really curious about your YouTube channel, and I'm really curious about how your background in education research has influenced the way that you think about creating content for YouTube or for similar mediums.
Yeah, well, I mean, doing a PhD in science education gives you some insight into that whole field, and I think that was, something that I drew on when I started Veritasium and I started making videos. You know, I thought it was really important to address misconceptions. So, I spent a lot of time talking to people you know, out on the street to find out what they thought before actually trying to teach them anything. And I think that's kind of a key to good science education.
So did that experience of having those conversations on the street, did that lead to your research project for your PhD, or that kind of, like, what direction did that flow in?
It's the other way around. Yeah. So I started out doing the PhD from about 2004 to 2008, and that's where I came across all this material around how alternative conceptions really are what prevents people from learning science effectively. And it was only when I was finished that, and after I'd worked for a while as a teacher, that I started to make YouTube videos, and I tried to draw on that experience that I had from the PhD, and that's why I talk to people on the street.
So, yeah, a lot of these videos, you're sort of finding somebody on the street, posing them a question. They often get it wrong. Then sort of using that as a moment to kind of teach the audience. So, I mean, is there research that shows that that's sort of the way to go versus just an outright lecture?
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, that was sort of the basis of my PhD, was finding that if you just present the correct information, you will often not teach anybody anything. That was kind of a surprising finding, I thought. It was surprising to me that, you know, a straightforward lecture-style presentation with real-world examples, diagrams, animations, was just ineffective for helping people understand physics.
So even what we think of as a pretty good lecture, where it's a little bit more, there's a little more multimedia, That's still not quite doing it. It needs to be more interactive.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think we should be careful because, you know, if you are talking to people who have a bit more experience in the subject, then the misconceptions are not such a big deal. But it's really for novices where I found this result is very, very robust. So, you know, I would test students before and after watching a lecture style summary. And they would report learning a lot from the material, and they said it was clear and concise, and it was easy to understand, and they really got it. But when I went to assess their understanding, they really didn't perform very well at all. That they hadn't learned anything. It's just that they thought that they had learned something. And I find that sort of the most troubling, maybe, of all, is that, you know, people have the illusion of learning when they watch a lecture, but they're not actually getting anything out of it. And that's... Yeah, that's what I'm trying to combat.
Do you think it's because they're failing to comprehend the material, or because they've got misconceptions that aren't getting corrected?
Well, I think it's a complex process where they think they understand what's being presented to them, but they're having a completely different experience of the lecture than the lecturer is having. So it's like this communication where the sender of the information is thinking that they're saying something completely different than the receiver is taking away from that message. So it's like mismatched conversations. And that really happens when there are strong misconceptions on one side, because then, you know, the learner thinks that their pre-existing beliefs are being confirmed when really they're not.
So it's just too one-directional. The professor's not getting feedback on what the class is understanding or not understanding.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's really important. I mean, I've come across cases where I didn't expect there to be certain misconceptions. For example, you know, what happens to the food once you put it in your body? You know, to me, it's self-evident that as an adult, every atom you put into your body must sort of, in a way, over time, be substituted by an atom coming out of your body. Otherwise, you build up atoms, and that means you get bigger, which obviously is not happening to most of us for most of the time. I mean, as long as we're not eating too much. So it was a surprise to me to find people out there who believe that, you know, once you eat the food, it somehow disappears inside you. It's like, you know, I had someone explicitly say to me, not everything that goes in comes out. You know, it's, you know, they were thinking that some is burned, quote unquote, and just kind of used up, without really a sense that, you know, you can't burn up matter. I mean, it has to go somewhere. The atoms have to go somewhere. So this idea of the conservation of the number of atoms, you know, I was really surprised to find that people didn't have that as sort of an innate sense of the way the world works.
So can we really fix this problem with, like, the necessity of education, where, you know, it's hard to have one teacher sitting down with one student, but in a classroom environment where it's one teacher and 50 students or 100 students, or for that matter, a YouTube channel where it's one person and a million viewers, can you overcome this problem?
Look, I don't think that we're going to solve it in any kind of simple silver bullet way. I don't think that my channel solves it on a global scale, but I do think that we can do better than a direct expository lecture. I certainly think that is possible, and that's something that I aim to do in my YouTube videos. I also think that the videos I do can hopefully inspire teachers to try to ask some of the questions I ask and sort of see where their class is at. And, you know, I'm just kind of trying to model a teaching style. I worked for 7 years before I made YouTube videos as a teacher and a lecturer at university. And my teaching style always involved a lot of interaction with my students because, you know, if you're not doing that, then I think you can be fooling yourself as an instructor about how much your students know and how much they're actually learning from your teaching. So it's always been my goal to not fool myself like that.
So do you have a target audience in mind when you make those videos?
These days, my target audience is really kind of someone like me. So I look for topics that really interest me and then things that I think are cool. And I learn more about them and then I help make videos about them. You know, I've sort of changed the focus, you know, from the beginning when I started my YouTube channel. I wanted to reach people who didn't know very much about science. And I wanted to take them basically through, you know, from start to finish. But that is not something that I've stuck with over time because it's actually a very difficult audience to reach, you know, people who might be interested in science, but haven't learned science, haven't been taught science. That's, not really a big audience and they're tough to find and tough to engage.
Hmm. I wonder if that might be a little bit easier on television.
Yeah. I wonder too. I mean, I'm sure you do get a different audience on TV and you get an audience of people who have less of a science background, but, so I guess, you know, I've been doing a bit of TV, hopefully to get into that, to go that direction.
Yeah. Well, like Neil deGrasse Tyson's show, Cosmos, I didn't get the sense that it seemed like he was not making too many assumptions about the science education of his viewers, which is good.
Yeah, but, that's right.
Yeah, I can see how that could be really challenging to have such a broad reach.
Yeah. I mean, with TV is quite different, where you've just kind of got a captive audience. So whoever's going to watch, you know, National Geographic or Fox at that time is just going to watch it because they're bored. With YouTube, you really have to draw people in. So in that way, you have to target your audience more carefully and make sure that there is a sizable audience to get.
Yeah. So you've got a really amazing Kickstarter project going right now that I want to talk to you about called SNADMs, which is like a new way of modeling molecules. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so, you know, as a teacher, I always wanted a really quick molecular building kit and something that gave people the sense of how atoms bond together to form molecules. And, of course, there's the old ball and stick kits that have been around forever. But I thought, you know, maybe we could do something better. So for the last 3 years, I've been developing what is essentially, you know, these magnetic atoms. They all snap together. So, you know, they're more accurate than the old ball and stick models and they're, you know, they allow you to feel the attraction between atoms, which I really like. And, you know, you can rotate the atoms around the single bonds very easily. So, it's all of those things that I think, you know, make it much more fun to play with molecules. And that's what I'm hoping to help do is change the way people learn about chemistry.
So what do you mean by saying that they're more accurate? Like, what's more accurate about them?
Well, you know, a ball and stick is not a particularly accurate representation of a molecule. You just have these overlapping electron orbitals, and that's how bonds form. So, you know, I think when you form this sort of space-filling molecule, it looks much more like the actual molecule itself would look.
Right. So these SNADMs are designed so there's a flat surface where the magnet is, so that they look essentially like overlapping spheres when they're connected together.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is a very good description. I have not described it that well myself.
So I also wonder, can this reach a different audience than the traditional kind of ball and stick model can? Because it seems a little friendlier.
I certainly hope it can. You know, I think I built this kit where I'm hoping, you know, parents may buy it for their kids who may play around with it without even knowing, you know, what these little things are, and it's only later in their life they realize, oh, that was carbon and that was oxygen, that's hydrogen, and they have this sort of intuitive sense of how atoms bond together. So I guess the idea is to build from an early age the idea, the sort of basic concepts of chemistry.
Do you think that there's sort of a limit where you get a more complex molecule, or you need something a little bit more rigid?
I'm currently working on some modifications, some different designs where I think that we can build even bigger molecules.
Wow.
Bigger, more complex molecules. So that's kind of the next step. I took a scientist approach to my idea of developing an educational product, which was, you know, make the simplest thing that you can that might be workable, see if people are interested in it, and if they are, go to the next step and try to add a bit of complexity, try to make things more sophisticated. So I'm now at that next stage.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And the initial kit on Kickstarter is pretty straightforward. There's carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen.
Yeah, six carbon, six hydrogen. Six carbon, six oxygen, and 12 hydrogen. So you can make glucose, of course, a basic sugar molecule, which I figure is, you know, something that everyone wants to make. You can make your carbon dioxides and your water molecules, and you can make your sugar. So that was what I thought was the most basic sort of useful kit that I could put together.
Yeah, and this thing's been taken off, which is really exciting.
I'm looking at it
right now, and it's you know, a few hundred thousand dollars, which is amazing.
It is. It is incredible. It is incredible. Yeah. I did not expect this kind of response. You know, we set the target at 42,000, which was, you know, as much as I would need to sort of make those kits. And I've just been blown away by the response.
Yeah. There's a pretty exciting stretch goal that I hope you make, which is, I think it's 420, where you have double and triple bonds, which will be exciting to see.
That is right. Yeah, the double and triple bonds. That's been everyone's concern is like, you know, again, going with the most basic idea of everything snapping together, you know, it's all single bonds on single flat faces. How do you do a double bond? People have been quite worried about this, and I don't think it's that big of a challenge, really, because if you have a spring with two magnets, you know, one at either end, you can, you know, put two of those on and connect up two of those flat faces, and there you have your double bond. So I think it shouldn't be a problem, but I'm looking forward to hitting that stretch goal. I really hope we get there, and then, you know, we'll have another kit available that's more fully fledged, that has more options.
And for the listener, when this episode's going out, you only have about a week to back this project.
Oh, wow.
We have about a week and a half turnaround for these episodes.
Fantastic.
So yeah, the timing is actually pretty good for the listener, because you're going to hear this and you should act now. Because I think if you just go to Kickstarter and Google Snadams, that's probably the easiest way to find it. And it's like the word atom, but with an SN at the front of it, because they're snapping together.
Yeah, I don't even know how that came about, the name. It just came to me one day. It wasn't even like I was thinking snap atoms, Snadams. Just like it just popped into my head. So and it just felt right. So that's the name.
Well, and you've talked a bit about how that snapping action, you think you feel is a better representation of the energy in those bonds. Could you describe that for us?
I mean, it's been a long time sort of pet peeve of mine. So when you ask someone about, okay, you get energy from food, you get energy from glucose, where does that energy come from? And people will say, oh, it comes from the bonds between the glucose atoms, it comes from the bonds in the glucose molecule. And that, to me, just seems a little bit unsatisfactory, because, of course, when you break a bond, you have to put in energy. So it's weird for me, I think, to think of bonds as areas where energy is stored. I think it's a much more satisfying explanation to say that bonds form when energy is released. So you put, you know, an atom, two atoms together, and they snap together because they go to a state of lower energy, and they release some energy in that bonding process. That's the whole idea of bonding. So I just felt like we could get a much better holistic sort of conceptual understanding of bonds to approach it in this way. Now, of course, with snadums, you can feel that when you put two atoms near each other, they pull towards each other. And then if you let go, they snap together. You hear the sound come out, right, which is some energy being released. And if you want to break them apart again, you have to put energy in. Okay, so now I hope we understand that, you know, bonds are not stores of energy. They're sort of negative energy, if you want to think of it. They're energy debt. So if you want to break a bond, say in glucose, you have to put energy in. This helps us understand things like activation energy, right? Like you can't just start, your candle just doesn't burn itself down unless you add some heat first. So this will hopefully help people get that idea. Okay, you got to put energy in, break apart those bonds. But the nice part is the new bonds you form can be more energy debt than the bonds you broke, and that way you get energy out of the system. So I see this as a more complete way of understanding bonding. And, you know, for me, it's one of these pet peeves that I had for a long time, and I'm hoping this this kit will help people get over that misconception.
Yeah, I can certainly see ways in which this is aiding understanding beyond what the kind of ball and stick thing does. I mean, that helps you a little bit with structure, but I can see that there's lots of misconceptions that people are getting from that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question. I asked Hank Green, because I was talking to him about this on SciShow Talk Show like a year ago, which was, you know, why do we say the energy's in the glucose bonds and not say in the oxygen bonds? Because in the absence of oxygen, you can't burn your glucose. So really, it's both sets of bonds that you're breaking to form, you know, your water and your carbon dioxide. So I don't know. I just want people to have a more nuanced understanding of bonds. I used to teach kids about binding energy of nucleons. So this is, you know, binding the nucleus together. And we would say, you know, what is the binding energy? And kids would say to me, well, it's the energy that is required to bind the nucleus together, to hold it together. And I feel like that is this persistent misconception, right? Like in our world, anything you want to bind together, you have to do something to it, like strap it up with tape. You have to put in some energy to bind things together. But that's not the way that the subatomic world works. The subatomic world works in this way that when things get bound together, they've actually lost energy to get to that state. That's why they're bound. And to break them apart, that's where you put in the energy. So, you know, it's about changing people's perception of what a bond is, why a bond forms, and what the energy dynamics are around that situation.
So that conversation you're referencing with Hank Green, I'll put a note about that in the show notes for the audience. It's really interesting, and you guys should check it out. And also, there's an adorable skunk at the end of the conversation.
Yeah, that was a great interview with Hank. I love that.
So one other question I have, and this goes a little bit beyond science and more about just the nature of Kickstarter, is what has that process been like? And what has it been like to figure out how to manufacture these things? Because it's this interesting world where there's all these artists and, you know, authors and creators on Kickstarter, you know, having this massive success and then having the challenge of, okay, how do I actually manufacture hundreds of these things and get it out in the world?
Right. Yeah. The manufacturing process has been something I've been concerned about for years. So I've been trying to make Snatoms for about 3 years. You know, I started out, you know, in my kitchen with styrofoam balls and little spherical magnets. And, you know, I progressively worked up. I got in contact with factories in China. So, you know, before I got to the Kickstarter stage, I really had this, you know, my sort of budget all laid out. And I had, I knew which factory I was going to work with and what the packaging would be and shipping. So, so everything got worked out up front, but that has been a long, challenging process for me because of course, you know, that's not my background. So, you know, it's been a whole new world and a very steep learning curve. The Kickstarter process thus far has been really very simple. It's just about, you know, getting all your information, telling your story as clearly as you can on the website. And I think it's phenomenal that this exists now so that so many people can get access to funding and to making cool ideas happen that, you know, never would have happened before. So I think it's one of the really exciting things that's happening on the internet right now. But yeah, what a process. It's really something different.
And I certainly think if there's people listening that are thinking about Kickstarter, you know, as a place to launch something, that checking out your project's a good idea. Cause one thing I love about your video is it's about 10 seconds in and I understand exactly what it is.
that's kind of from my YouTube sensibilities,
right?
where, you know, I was talking to people who were saying, oh, Derek, you should make your video more, you know, about your story, start at the beginning, work through it. And that's not my sense. My sense is in the first 10 seconds, someone has to know what it is you're doing. And I just tried to make that as clear as possible. I actually shot the video about 3 or 4 different times to get to the eventual one that you see there. So there were sort of iterations, you know, even with the Kickstarter, to try to make it as clear as possible.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. So before we wrap up here, is there anything that you'd like our listeners to check out? Anything you want to plug?
Well, I think Snatoms would be the best thing. This is a week before Snatoms closes. As I say, right now I've been developing over the weekend, which was the holiday weekend. I actually bought a 3D printer on the Black Friday sales. And so I've been spending my sort of holiday weekend feverishly making this new advanced form of Snatoms, which may or may not be released soon on the Kickstarter. So this is a new idea to try to make bigger molecules, more complex molecules, work in more elements, more things like that. So, you know, there's a chance that that's also on the Kickstarter by the time your listeners hear this.
So are we talking about potentially a fourth or a fifth molecule?
Yes, yes, we certainly are. We're talking about more atoms, more elements, and we're talking about a bigger kit, and we're talking about the capability of building bigger molecules before they would sort of reach their magnetic limit of size.
And folks can check out your YouTube channel, Veritasium. Mm-hmm. And I think you're on Twitter at the same thing, right? At Veritasium?
Yeah, Veritasium is the word that'll find me anywhere on the internet, and Snatoms is the word which will find Snatoms anywhere on the internet as well.
All right, thanks so much, Derek.
Hey, thank you.
So we want to try something new on the podcast, which is an Ask Useful Science section. So what we want you to do, dear listener, is if you have a question about science, or maybe even just a question about life, frankly, just write to us. You can tweet at us at UsefulSci on Twitter, or you could email us, which is podcast@usefulscience.org. And we will do our best to find you a science-based answer, and then we'll talk about that on the show. We have this really incredible team of scientists and science students that work with us. If you go to usefulscience.org/about, you can see them all listed there. It's just dozens of people with really solid backgrounds in science and really strong interests in looking for sort of the useful applications of science in everyday life. And we would love to, you know, try this out. Like, let's get some real questions from people and let's find some real answers and talk about it on the show. So again, just tweet at us, usefulsci on Twitter, or email us podcast@usefulscience.org. So, Andrew, let's move on to your story.
Sure. So the useful science summary for this one is teaching seventh graders that intelligence is not fixed, but malleable, and that it can be improved through hard work resulted in an upward trajectory of math grades in junior high school. And this comes from a paper called Implicit Theories of Intelligence Predict Achievement Across an Adolescent Transition, a Longitudinal Study and an Intervention. And what I think is really interesting about this study, I'll just start off by saying, is that it gets a really just a very interesting question. Does it matter what we believe about intelligence? And does it matter what we believe about our capacity to change our own intelligence? Does that actually become a part of intelligence in the world? And are some beliefs about intelligence actually more useful than others? And should we try to have those beliefs or those mindsets? So I'll just jump into the structure of the two studies and the results, and then I'll come back and talk about some of the caveats and maybe possible criticisms. Well, I should mention also the researchers who wrote this paper, Lisa S. Blackwell of Columbia University, and then I might be botching this name, but Kelly H. Chinooski and also Carol Sorich Dweck of Stanford University. Carol Dweck is actually a really important figure in this sort of a growth mindset field of social psychology. She wrote a book recently called Mindset, the New Psychology of Success. That's really popular. These ideas are really becoming more and more widespread. So anyway, the first part of the study, the longitudinal component, it took 373 seventh graders in four different classrooms in the same school. It's a public secondary school in New York City. And the same teacher. They all had the same teacher who was teaching them math. Very varied in ethnicity, achievement, and socioeconomic status. There's about a 50-50 split of male-female, so it was a good sample. And they used math scores particularly because math, they thought, is something that's challenging. Definitely requires intelligence to do. It's also very measurable. You can either do a math problem or you can't. So it's a pretty good limited way of testing sort of concepts of learning and intelligence. And to track math achievement, they use the citywide achievement test, which is the CAT. I think public school kids, maybe actually all kids in New York City have to take that test. And they also combined that with some of their data was taken from just term grades assigned by the teacher. So anyway, the way that they set about trying to figure out what these students' theories of intelligence were, basically their these are two very important concepts for understanding this. They're two different types, two different basic theories of intelligence, which exist on a spectrum. And every person can be thought of as inhabiting some place on the spectrum. On one side, you have entity theory, which is the belief that intelligence is innate. It's something that's sort of hardwired into you, something you're born with. You either have it or you don't. There's not much you can do to change it. The other theory is incremental theory, which is the idea that you can take steps to improve your intelligence, that learning can actually enhance your intellectual abilities, that you have some control. And everyone exists in somewhere on the spectrum. Carol Dweck, in her book, she said something about, she estimated that 40%, I'm not sure where she got these numbers from, but 40% of Americans ascribe to more of an entity theory, 40% ascribe to more incremental theory, and the rest are kind of unclear, or they don't necessarily fit in. So anyway, to go about figuring out which of these theories of intelligence these students displayed, they gave them a questionnaire. And the questionnaire asked them questions about, well, it asked them to agree or disagree with certain statements that mostly just got at, directly at theory of intelligence, statements like, agree or disagree, it doesn't matter whether I study or not. After that, they looked at learning goals, more motivational factors. So there are a number of motivational factors that seem to correlate very strongly with these theories of intelligence. Learning goals, question like, how important is learning as a motivation? They called effort beliefs. Does effort lead to positive outcomes? Responses to failure. They would give students this scenario. You start a new class at the beginning of the year. You really like the subject and the teacher. You think you know the subject pretty well. So you study a medium amount for the first quiz. Afterward, you think you did okay, even though there were some questions you didn't know the answer for. But then the class gets the quizzes back and you find out your score, you only got a 54, and that's an F. So they would give students that scenario and say, and ask them a series of questions, trying to figure out whether they would attribute this failure to something that was outside of their control, something that was external, and or whether they would be more focused on taking steps to get a better score next time, which is also something that they've found correlates strongly with theory of intelligence. They found that as students transitioned into junior high school, their theory of intelligence was a significant predictor of their math achievement. They also found that this incremental theory of intelligence at the beginning of junior high predicted higher grades by the very end of junior high, by the end of eighth grade. So it did have an effect. The second study, the intervention, which I think was a bit more interesting, they selected a slightly lower achieving sample of students. There are 99 students. They're all seventh graders initially. And they ranked about the 35th percentile nationally in math scores. So they're pretty low achieving. So they split them into an experimental group and a control group. And they used the same questionnaire to try to get a sense of their theory of intelligence, their motivations. With each of these groups, they throughout the course of the spring term, they gave them eight 25-minute lessons, one a week, in which they would receive instruction on physiology of the brain, how good kinds of study skills, anti-stereotypic thinking, which is anti-stereotypic thinking is just kind of showing them the fallacies inherent in the kind of thinking that sees things in terms of stereotypes, generalizes a lot based on specific traits. But only students in the experimental group were taught that learning changes the brain and that it actually forms new connections, that when you learn a fact, new neuronal connections are formed. And also that students themselves are, to some extent, in charge of that process. So only the experimental group learned that. The other group, they also had a lesson on the same day, but they learned something about mnemonic devices that didn't have that same message. So that was the content of the intervention, and it did have a surprising effect. It the change in theories of intelligence, just to start off with, to show how effective the intervention was, the average score on the test, it was a 6. The scale was between 1 and 6, moved from 4.36 to 4.95. So there was a slight change in theories of intelligence as a result of the intervention. Afterwards, 27% of students in the experimental group were cited as showing positive change by their teachers, versus only 9% in the control group. And the teachers had no idea which were which. They were just sort of spontaneously citing students if they had the idea that they were changing their behavior.
Can you really keep it a secret from the teachers? Wouldn't the students go back and talk about what they learned?
That's true. They may have.
Yeah.
But the teachers didn't know. These weren't the teachers who were teaching the intervention. They didn't know what the study was about. So even if their kids did talk about that, they wouldn't necessarily link it to learning about the specific idea of learning. So while the students group as a whole was decreasing in grades throughout, because it is kind of interestingly a phenomenon when kids go into junior high school, their math grades go down over the course of those 2 years in general. Actually, that decline was eliminated for those who had received the intervention. And it was as if they had just sort of, they dipped down, but then they came back up, and it was a sort of a flatness to their math performance, whereas normally there's a downward slope. So that's about the extent of, that's about what the two studies cover. Just in terms of usefulness, I think it just shows that having what's called, what Carol Dweck has called a growth mindset, could be really beneficial. If you just have this belief that your intelligence is fluid, malleable, something you can control, that actually opens up new possibilities, and you'll be more motivated because you'll have a reason to be motivated. I would temper that by saying that really this effect, they acknowledge even in the introduction to the paper, only seems to exist, or has only been found to strongly exist, in times of great stress or sort of tumult. Moving into junior high school is one time when there are a lot of challenges, things are changing very quickly, and it does seem like this effect is very real then, that kids who have incremental theories of intelligence tend to handle the change a lot better. One thing I think is a little bit, casts a little bit of doubt on it, or something that is worth being suspicious of, is that theory of intelligence was not significantly correlated with any of the students' prior math test scores. And these kids are going into seventh grade. It's just, considering that math is a very cumulative skill, something that you really have to keep on top of for a while in order to be at the expected level of skill, it's a little bit weird that this never had an effect before, that their theories of intelligence wouldn't have determined in some way their performance by the time they reached the seventh grade, but just starts to affect them when they enter the seventh grade. But in general, I do think this is an interesting example of just how belief can enable a certain kind of reality. It can affect the course of your life. I think the most succinct way to express this is there's that famous quote from Ford, who said, "Whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right."
It's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we've all known that kid, or we were that kid, perhaps, who felt like they weren't a math person, right? Well, I'm just not good at math. I'm just not a math person.
Yeah.
And so we're saying that removing that notion could be very valuable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so that's one interpretation. But let me get a minor criticism before getting a larger criticism. I'm a little bit suspicious about the use of a questionnaire to try to determine an implicit belief. It seems like these are kinds of things that people may be acting on without being consciously aware of. At least it seems like a possibility. And to just sit someone down and say, like, do you agree with these statements? It seems, for one thing, like that those kinds of questions, like imagining myself as a kid, I feel like I kind of would know what they wanted me to say. But also, even if I were answering them honestly and trying to answer them as truthfully as possible, I'm not sure I would know. I'm not sure I would even pick the answers that really pointed to my personal beliefs about intelligence. So that's one criticism. The other one is less to do with the study itself and more to do with how a lot of people seem to have taken it. I was reading a lot of things on the internet where people were kind of using this as evidence for these kinds of claims that talent or genius are just aren't real. These concepts of innate ability don't exist at all. And that everything comes down to mindset, and which leads to the kind of ugly idea that anyone who's failing might be doing it because they have the wrong mindset, or because they basically are afraid of being found out to be unintelligent, that they're acting solely based on a desire not to be discovered as not having certain innate traits. And it doesn't really say anything at all, this study, about how important learning actually is in intelligence. It actually only tells you how important believing certain things about learning is. So you can't extrapolate from this that actually intelligence is more fluid and malleable. You can only say that it helps to believe that.
So in the study, we're talking about younger people, like seventh graders, right? I'd be interested to see what, I guess, older students, those are maybe in entering university, what their beliefs on this type of intelligence is. I'm curious, and like as a follow-up to that question, are the younger students more impressionable or like more malleable on their belief of intelligence compared to the older students who've maybe like already come to their belief system and are less averse to changing it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It does seem like that over time you would a person has so many examples in their life of, you know, times that they tried harder and it worked, or times that they tried harder and it didn't work, that eventually that these theories are at least based on more evidence. But who knows if that necessarily results in there being more accurate or even far more helpful.
Well, you could imagine there being sort of a confirmation bias in that if your attitude is that trying harder is not going to work, that the brain isn't malleable, then, you know, a decade of believing that and not trying harder might reinforce that belief. So I could imagine somebody being less
feedback effects.
Yeah, exactly.
I think another really interesting point that you touched on was the idea of like an innate skill, whether you're born really good at math or really, you know, you have this like proficiency. And it brings up the idea of how if you practice a skill, like anyone can become an expert if you practice 10,000 hours or something. Like I've read articles about that. And it's like, I wonder how much validity there is to that statement that certain people are born with proficiencies of certain skills. Or is it really that anyone can simply master any skill with enough practice?
This is like a massive philosophical question.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think we're going to be able to answer this because a lot of people have spent, you know, 20 years of research trying to answer exactly that.
Well, I think that there's, I would imagine that it depends on where you set the threshold, right? Like if you look at people who are truly geniuses at something, like an example I was thinking of is Magnus Carlsen, the chess player, who's... I think he's the highest rated chess player ever or something like that. Like you could probably, you know, the average person could probably spend their entire life and probably not become that good. But, you know, to become a good enough chess player to be able to compete in tournaments and do really well, that's probably possible for most people. Mm-hmm. So if you look at those outliers, then maybe there is such a strong genetic component that nobody could really achieve that unless you're that person or you're a person like that person. But for mastering a skill to a level that actually is really meaningful and allows you to do that successfully, that's probably possible for most people, I would think, I would hope.
Yeah. And I mean, that's mirrored by a lot of, my interpretation of the modern research is that there's a certain, you know, genetic component or let's say nature component that, because they describe it as the nature versus nurture argument, right? And there's kind of a window that is set by your nature component, and then your nurture component also kind of defines a window, and the overlap is where you lie. So you're going to have some window that's predetermined by your genetics or by your upbringing or by your expression of your genetics or whatnot. And then there's also a component that is nurture that, you know, you can push a lot, but you might not be able to get to, you know, the very best in the world or something like that. But yeah, no doubt you're still going to be, you know, good.
Yeah. I think that's all very true. I would want to be a little bit careful. Just, I feel like it's very easy when you talk about nurture to assume like that most people have that under control. Like most people get to pick kind of like not just pick the skills that they pursue, but also have the resources just to actually pursue them in a meaningful way.
Sure.
Which I think gets at maybe another kind of strange thing about the study. It's just, it seems like the reason to do this kind of research is partly so that you can try to figure out ways to help people who are struggling, or who are more inclined to struggle. People with low incomes, or minorities who don't have the support they need, you're trying to figure out new techniques that you can teach them to make them better able to adapt. But in a weird way, it seems to sort of cycle back and become more like a justification for the fact, or it can come become sort of justification for the fact that they haven't adapted, and more like an explanation for it. You can say like, well, it's all really about mindset. Anyone can do this. If they put their minds to it, they can at least be good enough. Mm-hmm. And that, instead of being a good trick, becomes more like a moral failing.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And a justification to not provide support and things like this. Absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm.
That's a really great point. Thank you for that, Andrea. That's sort of like, I think it's a very American way of thinking of, you know, anybody can achieve if we just give them the room to achieve.
If they want it enough.
If they want it enough, exactly. Yeah, they can pull themselves up by their bootstraps. But
that's right.
The reality is that, you know, things are just not that equitable. You know, people aren't growing up in the same environments or having access to the same resources. Oh, this is getting heavy, guys. Oh.
It's hard to avoid talking about it with all the political rhetoric going on with the upcoming election and stuff.
Yeah, I think that, guys, can we just talk about Star Wars for a few minutes? you know what I'm doing right after this podcast recording is I'm going to a Spaceballs party. We're going to watch Spaceballs.
Some good Canadian classic humor.
I've never seen it. I'm looking forward to seeing it for the first time with a group of friends too.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. Great. I envy you.
it rings true, right? This idea that if you tell people that they can achieve more, that their brains are more malleable, that they will achieve more, it rings true. It seems like kind of fits well with my kind of own ideology, and that always makes me a bit nervous about are we reading too much into a small effect? And I worry about that when something seems so intuitive.
Yeah.
Well, that's why it gets published, right? I mean,
yeah.
I agree is that, you know, if ever you find something is really intuitive and just makes sense, it's always a good idea to question it, because it's always when it's counterintuitive that, you know, we would always naturally question it. Whereas if it just kind of quote unquote makes sense, we just accept it and move on without really questioning it and you know, really critically evaluating it and thinking about it.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually.
So speaking on this, there was the whole, I was reading some other stuff and related to this where it was, you know, there was a study, one of the other useful science links that said, you know, a giant meta study of tons and tons of people has shown that men and women are equally good at math.
Yeah,
and
I saw that too.
You know, of course, the response from some people is, oh, well, of course, why did they need a scientific study from this? But the thing is if you had equally said, oh, well, you know, a meta study has shown that, you know, men are in fact better than women at math, some people would also just use quote unquote common sense to justify it and say, oh, well, no, that's of course why, you know, so many more men are in science and physics and all this stuff. So it's, you know, you always have to be careful with what quote unquote makes sense, because it doesn't necessarily mean it's true. And a lot of people criticize social studies because they will prove something that, quote unquote, everyone knows. But if you look at old quotes from, you know, dead Greeks or dead Romans or whatever, you can justify really anything using a quote. So you could say, you know, patience is a virtue, or you could say haste makes waste. Wait, no, that's the same one. You could say he who hesitates is lost, or you could say haste makes waste. So doing these types of studies is really important, but it's also equally important to critically think about any time something, quote unquote, just makes sense or is intuitive, because our intuition is often wrong. I mean, that's the whole reason why we invented science, is because intuition is often incorrect. Intuition would suggest we're at the center of the universe.
Yeah, that's a great point.
It just feels right.
Yeah, I mean, it does. Everything feels right, except the phases of Venus don't work. I mean, that's the only that was the thing that set it astray, right?
All right, Mike. So let's move on to your story, which is about depression.
Yeah.
Fun.
Yeah. So, I mean, interestingly, the reason I chose this study, and I was debating between doing something a little more quote unquote useful that you could actually apply to your life, but I figured this is rather important because although it's only tangentially related to education, you know, a lot of people do go off to university, and that's a huge part of education for a lot of people. And so I thought it would be interesting to focus on that, because it is a really big part of many people's lives, and people are interested in how to adjust and how do I use science to get to do better or cope better with university life. So let me kind of go through this. I wrote some notes because it was, it's particularly lengthy. But the summary is that having a roommate who is vulnerable to depression increased college students' own vulnerability and symptoms of depression. And the reason that I found this was very interesting was because it was even the topic of a lot of debate among our internal boards of what kind of a summary do we want to post, because this publication was picked up by news outlets all over the world, and effectively they ran with the headline of depression is contagious, or you can catch depression, or things like that. And interestingly, that was in fact what they said is totally not the case. But you know, that we'll talk a little bit more about that, and that's why I thought it was so interesting.
So the article explicitly says depression is not contagious, yet everybody ran with that headline. Depression is contagious.
Yeah, and interestingly, so this was, there was a study published back in 1999 that looked at depression as an emotional contagion, and I'll explain what that is in just a sec. But effectively, to just say that emotions can be contagious in the same way that germs can be contagious. So they call it an emotional contagion because it's, you know, an emotion that is contagious. There was a previous big meta study that in 1999 that looked at whether or not depression was contagious. And actually, they found through their meta-analysis that depression is in fact contagious, and that actually most moods are contagious. So any sort of negative mood or positive mood is contagious. And listeners and you guys might both remember recently there was a big study published by Facebook, and they manipulated people's news feeds either positively or negatively, and found that it negatively or that it positively or negatively impacted people's emotions. So it was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. It was this really large scale experiment. So it had about 700,000 people, and they introduced either really negative things into people's news feeds and found that, you know, it influenced their mood negatively, or if they introduce positive things, that it introduced their mood positively. So the idea of this emotional contagion is actually not new, and has been, you know, demonstrated in many, many other studies, that some of which are extremely large. And particularly happiness, there's this great study that I came across that uses network theory and shows that, you know, happiness is also contagious. And it's not just like-minded people who hang out together, it's actually that people who are happy make others happier. And I thought that was a really interesting finding, in particular that they went through the trouble of distinguishing that, because I thought that was important. So, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, this study actually, they believe that it calls into question the previous work, because they found that symptoms of depression are not contagious. So if one of the roommates, and let me just make sure that I kind of summarize this accurately. Shucks, I didn't put that in the notes. Which is a shame because it's a rather central point.
That's right.
You know, it's not like I'm trying to get to a Spaceballs party or anything.
Right. Okay. So here's the really important part. So like I said, you know, this prior research had suggested that depression itself is contagious. But this study actually found, and I quote, "We did not detect a contagion effect for depressive symptoms. Roommates' baseline levels of depressive symptoms were not significantly associated with the participants' levels of depressive symptoms at either 3 or 6 months." So what they're saying
is
that,
that's totally the opposite.
Right. It's exactly the opposite. And so I thought that was really interesting that, you know, all these big news headlines kind of ran with the opposite. So I wanted to really chop this apart and kind of explain what they did find. And talk a little bit more about that. So it was this work was performed by researchers at the University of Notre Dame. And it was performed by Jared Heffel and Jennifer Hames. And I looked up some of the past work by Jared Heffel, and it was interesting because they actually developed an assessment or a questionnaire to look at cognitive vulnerability to depression. So they've been in this field for a long time, and I want to explain the word cognitive vulnerability because that's really what's central, and that's the wording in the Useful Science post actually was, this vulnerability to depression is what changed, and so that's what they were really looking at. So it was published in the Clinical Psychological Sciences in 2013. And to give you a sense of kind of where this is, I looked into it, and it's kind of in the top 10 of clinical psychology journals, so it's well respected. And the reason that I was drawn to this is because our idea of self is so tied to our character and emotional state. So, and you know, people would naturally say, "Oh, well, you know, you're influenced by those who are around you," and I think people would you know, take that as quote unquote common sense, you know, given our discussion earlier. But you know, our idea of who we are is something that's relatively static. And so I think it's easy, it's interesting that it can be influenced by even, you know, our roommate identity when we move off to university. To go into what cognitive vulnerability is, this whole idea of cognitive vulnerability is that you are at risk of developing depression. And so it doesn't mean that you will develop depression. But interestingly, I kind of looked into this because there's been a whole bunch of studies on whether or not people can predict this, because of course it's a really important topic. And so if there is some way to predict it, I mean, of course it would be really valuable. So people have done a whole bunch of research on this. So interestingly, there's a couple different ways that you can, or theories that are used to describe cognitive vulnerability. So one is the response style theory. And this defines cognitive vulnerability as the tendency to focus attention on one's negative mood and the implications of that mood. So they call that ruminating and brooding. And these are really negative behaviors. And people who have this tendency are at increased risk for severe and enduring depressive responses. So this response style theory, one of the questionnaires, the idea would be something like, "Oh, I feel sad today, but it's just a bad day." And that would be on kind of the better end of that scale. Whereas someone who is very ruminative or very brooding would say, you know, "I feel sad because I'm worthless." And so that kind of gives you an idea of the spectrum that you would take in this questionnaire at the two ends of this. So one of them would be, "Oh, you know, I feel sad today, but it's not me. It's just, you know, it's a bad day. I'll get over it. Everything will be fine." Versus, "I feel sad because I'm worthless. And that's something that, you know, isn't going to change." The second theory of cognitive vulnerability is the hopelessness theory. And this is, you know, described by the tendency of an individual to make particular kinds of inference about the cause, consequences, and self-worth implications of negative life events. So, for example, when someone is faced with a really stressful or negative life event, someone who has a cognitive vulnerability is likely to attribute the event to stable and global causes and view the event as likely to lead to other negative consequences. And then, you know, they construe this event as implying that they're unworthy or deficient. So this whole idea that if you have this hopelessness, it's caused by things that aren't going to change. They're very stable. Things are not going to get better, and this is just going to get worse. So these are kind of the two big theories of cognitive vulnerability, and this study actually tests for both of them, and they look at how they're stable at their initial assessment in 3 months and at 6 months. And what's interesting is not this study, but many past studies have shown that it's possible to take a group of never-depressed individuals and predict which of them will be most likely to develop a first episode of clinically significant depression. And this is based solely on their difference of their style of interpreting life events. And this is this cognitive vulnerability, right? So people who are score high on this cognitive vulnerability scale are more likely to experience depression or are at risk of depression. And the interesting thing is that this is also supported by prevention and treatment studies. And so if with these interventions designed to modify these cognitive vulnerabilities, those are among the most successful interventions available for depression. The other crazy thing is that, you know, we tend to think that by the time we're adults, we're pretty stable. Our character is generally well-developed and not dynamic is the wrong word, but isn't changing much. You know, we are who we are. And interestingly, these past studies have shown that by early adolescence, it's possible to detect meaningful differences in how individuals do interpret these stressful life events. So that supports this idea that, you know, by the time you're kind of an adult, you have a way of dealing with life and interpreting events. And in longitudinal studies and cross-sectional studies, you can use cognitive vulnerability to predict depression in children as young as 12 years of age. So if you do these cognitive vulnerability studies and you interview people at different stages of their life, you can detect their risk of depression as early as 12 years of age, which is really, I mean, pretty crazy, yeah, actually. And so, you know, what this suggests is that by the time you're 12, your level of cognitive vulnerability is kind of stable for either better or for worse. And you know, if you know that, then you can use active therapy to try and deal with that. And it's not always enough, right? I mean, but as I mentioned, these intervention strategies based on these theories of cognitive vulnerability are among the most successful from what I've read. So that's kind of the background upon which this is based. So you have this whole theory of emotional contagion, the idea that emotions can be contagious, and you have this idea of cognitive vulnerability and that some people's interpretation of life events can put them at more risk for depression. And so the hypothesis that comes out of this is, okay, if you take, you know, someone, if someone is stable and fully formed, if you have a very stressful or significant life event or you change their environment, can you change their maybe not personality, but their cognitive vulnerability or their risk for depression? And so what they do is they take, in this study, they took 103 pairs of roommates, and they took this from a Midwestern university in the United States where roommates are kind of assigned people. And the nice thing about this is that they're assigned roommates randomly. And so again, you filter out this bias of people pairing up with like-minded people, or, you know, people with similar tendencies to them. And so the roommates are assigned randomly by an external party. And then the researchers then go and have these email questionnaires. And they survey them at T0, and then they survey them at when they move in, and then they survey them at 3 months, and they survey them at 6 months. And what they find is not that, like I said, they do not find that depression is contagious and that one roommate's depressive symptoms influence the other. But what they found is that if one roommate has a high level of cognitive vulnerability, the other roommate will develop a higher level of cognitive vulnerability than they started with. And they used, once again, those two different questionnaires. So they looked at the response style questionnaire and the hopelessness, or response style theory and hopelessness theory, separate questionnaires for that. And yeah, so that's kind of the take home from this, is that you know, if you want to summarize it in terms of classic knowledge, it would be that, you know, emotions are contagious and that you become more like the people who you spend a lot of time around. And so if you spend a lot of time in a new environment where you're really adjusting to something and you're undergoing a lot of personality changes or maybe not personality changes is too strong a word, but you're, you know, undergoing what you feel are significant life changes to discover yourself, and you spend a lot of time around someone who has a cognitive vulnerability or someone who has, you know, any sort of mood, you are more likely to adapt that mood, or you will tend towards that average.
Does it work in the other direction? So if someone is less cognitively vulnerable, do they ever make their roommate also less vulnerable, or is it always in the direction of more vulnerability?
So I'm not sure about in this specific study, but in general, people will tend toward the mean. And so if you look at all these other studies on emotional contagions, if you surround yourself with happier people, you will tend to be happier. If you surround yourself with angrier people, you will tend to be angrier. These things are contagious. And so it will tend to average out. I don't know in this specific study if, you know, the other roommate who had a cognitive vulnerability became less cognitively vulnerable is effectively your question, right?
Yeah.
Here's what I'm confused about, Michael. So if being around a cognitively vulnerable person, a person vulnerable to depression, makes you more vulnerable to depression, but does not actually make you more likely to be depressed, doesn't that mean that our way of measuring vulnerability to depression is not good, right? If the vulnerability correlates, but the actual depression doesn't correlate, then how do we know that the vulnerability actually is a good predictor of depression? That's where I'm confused.
Right. So if you go back to some of the previous work, one of their theories of this cognitive vulnerability is that there's an interaction of this vulnerability with stressful or negative life events. And so just because you have a vulnerability or a predisposition to becoming depressed doesn't mean that you'll necessarily have any extreme negative or stressful life events that will interact with that and then lead to depression.
So, but isn't college even just having a roommate, isn't that a stressful event? how are they not being surrounded by stressful events?
Sure. There are a range of different events that people are exposed to. And, it would be fair to argue that in undergraduate, you are going to be exposed to more stressful events than, say, a control group who's not going to university, right? So there's going to be a lot of high-intensity events. But it's really the interaction of specific negative events and then how you interpret them and that leads to, or according to these theories, that would lead to depression. And so you're never going to be able to predict, that someone will become depressed. You can only say they have an increased chance or they are at risk of becoming depressed. And this is where, you're dealing with individuals versus averages. You can say, oh, well, you have an X percent chance of developing this, but, that doesn't mean that it's ever going to be a problem for you.
Yeah, so continuing the contagion metaphor, it's sort of like you're not actually catching a disease from the roommate. You're just maybe like catching their sort of immune system malfunction. It's more like a problem with your immune system than.
Yeah. And interestingly, there's, so Guy Winch is one psychologist who advocates for this idea of emotional hygiene and the idea that in the same way you would wash your hands to get rid of the germs for, physical hygiene, you should have several practices to ensure that you have a clean mind, if you will, and get rid of harmful emotions or harmful thoughts that can will negatively affect your outlook on life or your sense of well-being.
Okay, so that's our show. As always, you can find the show notes on our website. Just go to usefulscience.org/podcast/7, the number 7, because that's the episode number for this one. So we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at podcast@usefulscience.org. You can tweet to us at usefulsci on Twitter. And again, we really want to hear some questions that we can try to answer scientifically on our on future shows. So I want to thank our hosts for this episode, Kevin Niebert, who you can follow at Kevin Niebert. Am I saying your last name right?
Yeah, that's perfect.
N-E-I-B-E-R-T. Andrew Blevins. Is there really a zero in the middle of your Twitter name, Andrew?
There is, yeah.
Okay. Andrew Zero Blevins, the number zero. And Michael Galtis, who you can follow on Twitter at Kaboom Science. I'm Cameron Spencer. You can follow me at USonic. And I hope you have a very useful week. You're there, right?
Me?
Yeah.
Yes.
It makes me nervous when you're quiet, Mike. something must be broken.
Oh, we've only done like 3 podcasts and already you know me too well. Definitely include this in the actual recorded podcast bit.
All right. I'm going to only include you asking me to include it, but I'm not going to actually include it.
Oh,
that's the plan.
I'm sure you'll just like take an excerpt and a bunch of little pieces and just like use it to put some giant argument, almost like they do on reality TV.
I'm gonna make it sound like you're insisting that I include my discussion of Spaceballs in the podcast.
I think you're really going to enjoy Spaceballs. It's fantastic.
All right. Well, on that note.
Take care, guys.
All right, bye-bye.
Have a great week.
See ya.
Bye, guys.